say that the Lord was indirectly responsible for that. It's in all of my control of my mind and body. All right.
It's it, and you know, scientific truth sets you free too. When you begin to see some of these things and get some of these lies dispelled, it sets you free to worship God, to have a relationship with God. And I firmly believe that because I know it's been my own experience and seeing it happen to others. Because it all can go fit right into God's Word. Now, last time we talked about the flood, and it's a fascinating subject. We could talk, you know, for hours and hours and hours about it. About the evidence that's been discovered and the fossil record and the things that have happened, and a lot of these subjects are for the other class in evolution reputation. But for right now, let's move on in archaeology here to the next major event after the flood, as far as we're major Bible trends in Bible history are concerned, and that's the Tower of Babel and the dispersion of the nations. And we find that archaeology has something to say about this too, although in a more indirect way. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 10, verses 1 to 9. Just read the account here of what took place. Genesis chapter 10, verses 1 to 9. If you don't have your Bibles handy, you can just listen. You'll be all right. Genesis 10, verses 1 to 9. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were born sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshach, and Tirus, the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah, the sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their land, every one after his tongue, after their families in their nations. And the sons of Ham, Shem, Cush, and Mitzrayim, and Put, and Canaan, the sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, and Ramah, and Sabteca, the sons of Ramah, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Okay, we find here Nimrod beginning to gather the people together. We see in Genesis 11 that the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one. They have all one language. This they will begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they had imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and their confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence on the face of all the earth, and they left off to build a city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did confound there the language of all the earth. From thence did the Lord scatter them abroad on the face of all the earth. Okay. So we see here, yes.
What does it mean back in chapter 10? Verse 5. It's everyone after his tongue, after their family. And then it goes on to relate. Is this kind of like a prophetic?
Yeah, this statement here is kind of the result of what happens. He's not necessarily chronological here. And he's telling you what happened, and then he goes in to tell you how it happened through the Tower of Babel and how they got scattered, divided into the tongues of the nations and so forth. Although, it's not entirely clear now. It could be that there was some division, you know, and then they decided to gather together, and Nimrod kind of, you know, was going to bring them all together. So it could be that too. I'm not real sure here. I have to check into it some more and see exactly, you know, what the difference would be there. Could be either way. Yes, Jeff.
My Bible marking says that the chapter 11 is before chapter 10 here chronologically.
That's possible. I want to check into it some more. It's not real important for our considerations right now. The important thing here is concerning the Tower of Babel, and is there any archaeological evidence that such a tower did exist? Well, obviously the tower itself is no longer in existence, but what little evidence they do have in archaeology points to Babylon as the site of the Tower of Babel. The city is now Babylon, which would be reasonable. Or ancient Babylon as the site of the Tower of Babel. Now, Smith found an ancient tablet there in Babylon reading the following. Smith found an ancient tablet there in Babylon reading, the building of this illustrious tower offended the gods. In a night they threw down what they had built. They scattered them abroad and made strange their speech. This is an inscription found on an ancient tablet in Babylon. Okay. The building of this illustrious tower offended the gods. In a night they threw down what they had built. They scattered them abroad and made strange their speech. Made strange their speech. It's got the polytheism in it, of course, but it's probably a later account of this, but again, the account is there, yes.
What was the source that you got this from?
This is from Halley's Bible Handbook, page 84. Halley's Bible Handbook, page 84. The title was found by Smith. I think it's the same one that I was mentioning across before. Now, an interesting parallel was found in archaeology to the Tower of Babel. Of course, the tower itself is no longer in existence, but there are numerous towers that are very similar and may very well be similar to what the Tower of Babel did look like. In ancient Sumeria and Babylonia, many towers called ziggurats were built. You may have seen pictures of some of these. Spelled Z-I-G-G-U-R-A-T-S. A ziggurat is a type of built structure. They were built for the purpose of idol worship. And the Tower of Babel may very well have been the very first of these, or the prototype for all the ziggurats that followed. According to the description that's in the scriptures and so forth, the ziggurats were towers that were rectangular as far as the base and built in stages and usually had a temple to a false god at the top. Usually they were built in stages. We're looking at it from the side. Usually they have kind of an incline as they went up. If you were looking at it this way, but it would be kind of an inclined walkway that would circle around. You could wind around to the top. But they'd be built in several stages, some from 3 to 7 stages. I'll mention that a little bit later on. But the Tower of Babel may very well have been like this, with a rectangular base. If you're looking at it from the top, you know, it would be looking like this. Debbie Thutman, when she was back in the Middle East and traveling, and there took some slides, and I think it was in Iraq or Iran, that there's a picture of, I've got a picture of one of these things, one of these ziggurats. So it's got a round base. It's a little bit different because it was built much later on. It was built back in relatively modern times compared to these, but it was very interesting to see. You can get up in the tower and you can see all over the town. It's pretty high. I can't remember how high it was.
How big are these?
How tall are they? They vary quite a bit. One of them that was found at Ur of the Chaldees was 70 feet high, but I'm sure the others, the Tower of Babel itself was probably considerably higher than that. They varied. There were usually from 3 to 7 stages, and I'm not sure how many stages the one at Ur had, so I couldn't tell you for sure, but that one was 70 feet high.
Mm-hmm. Is it also conjectured that, or speculated that, that tower was built for worship of the stars and to be able to look at the stars in a more clear way?
Well, there's nothing in the scriptures that definitely indicates what it was built for, except just to defy the gods and to reach unto heaven and so forth, and to show man's accomplishments and his pride. But it's possible that this may have been another, because the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, later on, we know, were very deep into astrology and stars. So, but there's nothing definite that can tell us when we did. The only thing the scriptures indicates is that it was built, to reach unto heaven and for the purpose of exalting man and so forth. But that may have been involved. Now, the other ones, these later ones, were almost always involved with that, worship of the gods. And the gods are usually associated with the stars. See, that's why they wanted to get up close to the gods. Now, the Tower of Babel, it says they were going to build a tower in the heaven. That's figurative language, of course. They had no intention of building it all the way up past the clouds and so forth. They weren't totally ignorant of these things, and they knew that you had to have a certain size base to reach a certain height and these things. So they had no intention, this figurative language, to reach into heaven to reach into the gods. Maybe may have reference to the fact that they wanted to reach into God, but it's just showing their pride and their to have a big figurehead, a big building there, structure there they could all point to and bring unity among the people and so forth. Now, these towers were actually giant mountains of sun-dried brick. And this word ziggurat comes from the Babylonian word ziggurat, too. which means mountain. Mountain. So that's where the word comes from, and these are artificial mountains, you might say. Mountain or pinnacle is what the word means in Babylonian. They had clay in the inside, the interiors were clay, and they had bricks and bitumen or asphalt on the outside. Bricks and asphalt on the outside. Clay on the inside, usually.
Were they solid?
Right, they were solid, packed with clay on the inside. There were three to seven stages, usually of different colors. They'd have a different color for each stage, whether they did that with different colored clay or earth, or whether they had paint of some kind, I don't know. But there were 3 to 7 stages, usually of different colors. So you could have, this would be a small one, this would be 3 stages, you can have as many as 7 stages. They usually had a shrine at the top that housed the image of the city's patron god or deity. Right at the top there'd be a little shrine there that would have the image of the patron god of the city, and the god that would protect the city. Most of these cities had their own patron gods that were that's our god, that's the god of our city. You know? This is where the idea of a mascot originated from. Different teams have their own different mascots for their team. It came from this custom of having a patron god. Well, football teams and so forth, they have certain mascots in different schools, they'll have an animal or something like that, and will represent the school. This comes from the ancient practice of patron gods for different cities. Okay. But they had their own patron god. That god would protect that city, and that god would engage in battle with other gods, When the cities were at war, the gods were at war. And if you lost, it means your god lost, I don't know whether they did much changing. Their god lost out. Remember that Babylonian account of creation where they had that Marduk, that one god of Babylon, and they showed how tremendous he was and how he defeated all these others. Well, Babylon was in the stage of being built up, and this served the purpose of causing everybody to worship the patron god, and be behind him because he's the champion of all gods.
Remember, in the Old Testament, where the Syrians were having a hard time with Israel, and they were defeated in mountain hand-to-hand combat, and they determined that their god was the god of the plains, the chariot people, and the Yahweh must be the god of the mountain. If they get the Israelites down the plain, their god would be able to overcome Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work.
The same thing happened, the same thing happened with Mount Carmel. There, Baal was the fire god, and they figured if anybody could bring down fire, it'd be the fire god. It turned out that Yahweh was the one that could bring down the fire. Baal couldn't. Then Elijah said, maybe he's gone away on vacation. He's sleeping or something. But to them, this is their concept. This is they thought of their gods were glorified human beings, and they thought of their gods and engaging in feeding and doing all the things that people do. Now there are over 24 of these ziggurats still in ruins right now, 24 of them. So they're probably quite prevalent. They're probably almost any major city would have one that's dedicated to its god, and there are over 24 of these still in ruins, not in various stages of ruin. The oldest one is at Erech, R-E-R-E-C-H. This is where the oldest one of these remaining ruins of ziggurats are. And I believe it's, right here. Spelled E-R-E-K here, but you see variations of it. But that's nearer. Well, let's see, here's Babylon. Babylon's right here, so just a few miles south of Babylon. This is the oldest one remaining. The original Tower of Babel was not built for this purpose, probably, but rather in defiance of God. It's not clear. There's no mention there that they were building it unto a god or any of these things. It was too early for that. Polytheism and paganism hadn't really come in yet until they were dispersed from the Tower of Babel. So they were building it in defiance of God. There's no indication there that they're building it to another god. But that came later. Yes.
Does 24 of the ziggurats include any new world?
No, I believe that these are all written references. Now, there are some similar structures among the Mayans and some of the other, cultures and the Aztecs and things. They have very, very similar structures. And again, in the pyramids in Egypt, too, are very similar. The structure's a little bit different, but you see the same pattern, always wanting to build these towers. And it's probably because they all came from the same source. After they were scattered from the Tower of Babel, and over the face of the earth, they're probably all building these towers against these. So, but I don't know. I assume that these are just, you know, referring to Mesopotamia in that area and this type of structure. I couldn't be dogmatic.
How old were these old ones?
I don't have a date for the one in Erech. I would assume it would have to be around the time of Abraham, approximately 4,000 years ago, 2000 BC. I know it would be right around in that area, plus or minus a few hundred years for the oldest one.
Can this one possibly be contemporary with possibly contemporary just a little bit after the
Tower era? Right, within several hundred years after, probably. That's what I would say, because of the based on the dates of other things that were found at these different places, I would assume that would be the case. It could, none of them could be very, very recent. Although there are some, like I said, that one in Iran, or Iraq, one of these places, they're built much later on. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about Abraham. So there's not too much to say. As far as the dispersion of nations, this is a subject you can get into in anthropology. And most of the anthropologists will, trace the history of man and the dispersion of man from right in that very same area. Just like they just with animals and animal distribution, they trace it all right near Mount Ararat, in the Central Asia. And the only difference is they spread it out over a lot more years than the biblical account did.
How could they have gotten clear over America, the Indians?
It wouldn't have been very difficult at all when you understand what the conditions after the flood could have been. We don't know for sure what they could have been, but the land masses and the land bridges and so forth could have been quite a bit different. And even now, you can walk from here to Africa if you wanted to. If you go at the right time of year, you can cross the Bering Strait. It's all frozen over, and you can walk right across, and you can walk from one continent to the other, and you can walk all the way down. The only place you couldn't reach would be like Australia or something. And there's evidence that there may have been land bridges connecting Asia with Australia before. And, even the evolutionists talk about these, but they put it back millions of years, But the after the flood, see, when the waters are abating off the earth and things are taking place volcanically and other things as far as the reestablishing of the equilibrium, and we're not told for sure that everything was completely settled at the time of the flood, as soon as the water abated where they could walk around, they began to. So presumably conditions were, changing during this time, and there could have been a lot of things that we don't know now as far as migrations are concerned. Okay, and there's a lot of evidence that a lot of geological activity has taken place relatively recently in history, so we can't, it's dangerous to assume that the continents have always been the way they have even back to the flood. There could have been a lot of changes since then. But even so, without that, we can account for it. And see, the thing is, the Eskimos are Mongoloid peoples. The Indians, the American Indians, are Mongoloid type peoples that would come from Asia and China area. And you can even see the resemblances in the shape, the eyes, and the bones, and the cheeks, and so forth. So, and they know the anthropologists trace that, so they must have come across that northern area and come back down into the Americas. Okay. Now, talking about Abraham, the higher critics asserted that the Genesis accounts of Abraham and all the other patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and these others, are untrustworthy and unhistorical. They just assumed that. And one man named Noldeke, N-O-L-D-E-K-E, he said that Abraham didn't even exist historically. He denied the existence of Abraham altogether. Most of the higher critics wouldn't go that far, but they asserted that all of these accounts of Abraham and so forth were unhistorical and inaccurate, untrustworthy. But this one even denied the historical existence of Abraham altogether. But again, all these things were being charged before archaeology came into its own. In the 20th century, archaeology has confirmed this biblical account. We'll look at a few examples here of the things that they found that tie right into the existence of Abraham. First of all, the city of Abraham, Ur of the Chaldees, Genesis chapter 11, verse 31, just a reference to it. And we'll see that it's been excavated and what they found there. Genesis 11, 31. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot, the son of Haran his wife, the son's son, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife, And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came unto Haran and dwelt there. Now, Ur of the Chaldees is located right down here, the southern part of Babylonia, right down here. Now, some have argued that it's located up in here and so forth, but this, as far as I'm concerned, there's no basis for that. Ur of the Chaldees is located right down here. Right. Haran is up here. See, they went from down here up to here. And they stayed there for some time. We'll talk about that, too. That's been excavated as well. It hasn't been excavated, but they still exist. But Ur of the Chaldees is located down in the south part of Babylonia. Yes?
What is that area around now? Syria?
Let's see. I'm not sure if it's Syria or Iran or Iraq. I think it would be Syria. I think Syria goes up that far. I couldn't say. I wish we had a modern map here. It's pretty interesting. It would be pretty close to Syria. For a long few days, but I feel like that.
Okay.
Israel. Now, the city of Ur was thoroughly excavated in 1922 to 1934. 1922 began, 1934, Ur of the Chaldees was excavated thoroughly by a man named Leonard Woolley, and what's his name on the board? W-O-O-L-L-E-Y. Leonard Woolley. During these excavations, it was shown to be a large, flourishing city at the time of Abraham. Ur was shown to be a large, flourishing city at the time of Abraham. And that was approximately 2000 BC. And it had an advanced civilization. It wasn't some primitive group of savages. It was an advanced civilization at about 2000 BC, the time of Abraham. So they know that Abraham Kerr very well could have existed. The city that he was from did exist, and it had a high civilization at the time that he would have lived. The average middle-class citizen lived in large houses of from 10 to 20 rooms. The average middle-class citizen, which would be, you know, like we are, average middle-class citizen would live in large houses from 10 to 20 rooms. 10 to 20 rooms in a house. Where they built their houses had a lot of courtyards, and it would be kind of like, you know, buildings with a lot of different rooms and courtyards in the middle and stuff like that.
Well, didn't they practice a lot of, you know, family living together?
Yes, in the patriarchal life, they had a lot of people living together. But, and this would account for, you know, one of the reasons for it, because, you know, it doesn't do you any good to have all those rooms and only people living in. But still, people, you know, were living quite well off. Yes.
That's kind of a big house, don't you think?
Yes. You can't really. I'd like to see some pictures of the foundations of some of these things just to get a comparison as to what it would be for us now and how big the rooms were and so forth. They wouldn't be, you know, the materials they had to build out of what we have now. But the schools were in existence at that time. And remember, writing is mostly not to be invented for several thousand years from that time by the higher critic estimates of things. But here they had schools in existence way back at the time of Abraham, 2000 B.C. Woolley excavated a schoolroom from Abraham's time. Could very well be the school that Abraham went to, as far as we know, but it was definitely a schoolroom that existed in Abraham's time. And he found there in the schoolroom, he found 150 school exercise tablets. And the children, you know, for their exercise, would have tablets of clay, and they would, you know, mark, for writing their exercises, and probably learning the ABCs of the Babylonian alphabet. They found 150 school exercise tablets. They found math, medical, and historical textbooks on math, medicine, and history. To be sure, these were valuable. So they did have some medicine, and I don't know exactly how advanced it was, but historical and math texts. One large tablet was found with a complete conjugation of a Sumerian verb and its equivalent in Semitic. So they had a complete conjugation. Apparently they were teaching foreign languages and so forth. But they had the complete conjugation of a Sumerian verb in Sumerian language with its equivalent verb in Semitic and the conjugations of these verbs. And you can be sure this was a valuable thing as far as understanding the language and so forth. There's a complete conjugation of the verbs and all the verb forms and so forth. As I said, this may have been the school Abraham attended, as far as we know. Right time, right in the early county. Now, the most prominent building at Ur at this time that they excavated was the ziggurat. Of course, that's the center of most of these towns, the ziggurat. And in this specific case, the one at Ur of the counties was a massive solid brickwork like the rest of them were. The base of it was 200 feet long and 150 feet wide. So it's 200 feet by 150 feet. So it'd be a rectangle. I've got it out of proportion there, but mine looks more like a square. But it's 200 feet on one side, 150 feet on the other side. It was 70 feet high. 70 feet. The inner core was unbaked brick, and the outer facing of baked brick was set in bitumen. Unbaked brick would be like clay. That's probably why they call it clay before. It'd be unbaked bricks that they're set in, you know, and it becomes a solid mass of clay when they get that. And the outer facing was a baked brick set in asphalt.
Right.
Yeah.
When you say baked brick, was that fire in the kiln?
Right. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was fire in the kiln. Because they didn't have those back then. I can't tell you for sure, but I think it was. I know it, Nebuchadnezzar's time. Firing kill, we'll talk about this later on, what the pre-Hebrew children are going to do.
Really?
Now, the outer facing was 8 feet thick. These baked bricks were 8 feet thick, a thick coating around the outside of the baked brick. And then the inner core would be of clay. Now, this was an artificial hill or high place to worship the moon god Nannar. We hear a lot of the scriptures about high places. And apparently out in these plain places, they didn't have high places, so they made their own high places, these ziggurats. And Nannar was the name of the god of earth. Nannar was the moon god. And this is the patron god of Ur of the counties. Nannar. He's the supreme god of Ur. He was the moon god, yes.
I would take it the way they find out it was 70 feet tall is just mathematical projection from the size of the base.
I would assume so. Yeah, that's probably about the only way, unless the thing was buried to the extent where they did have maybe a sizable portion of the lower stage pillar. These things get buried pretty deep. You know, after 2,000 years, a lot of trouble, and even within 20 years, the way they've seen things happen, these things that they can cover up pretty quick. In fact, with the Egyptian pyramids, every 20 years or so, they have to clean the dust away. They have to clean the sand away from the bottom of the base of the pyramid because it would cover it up for a while. People have to pay taxes to have that done. Okay. Trees and shrubs were planted on stages to imitate a real hill. And they plant trees and shrubs up some of these things along the stages, to make it look like a real live hill. They have these high places of the grove and the high places that we're talking about in the later in scriptures. The walls of Ur of the counties were 2.5 miles in circumference and with a rough oval shape. If you look at the top of the city, these cities were not big like when we talk about cities today, and we're talking about quite a few miles. But the circumference of Ur with the walls is a roughly oval shape. The circumference around here is 2.5 miles. So you can see it's not very big. It means that it's only about a mile across, approximately. So we don't have a real... these cities aren't huge. We'll see later on that Jerusalem, in the time of David, is quite small, too. 2.5 miles of circumference. This is the original, at this period of time. Within the city was another walled area called the Timonos, which was the sacred area of Nannar. Within the city, I don't know exactly if I've got the layout right, but there was another walled area. This is the outer wall of the city. There's another walled area. Within this area, this is the sacred area, and they have a term for it. They call it the Temenos, T-E-M-E-N-O-S. This refers to the sacred area of the city, and this would be in general. This would refer to any of these old cities. But it was the sacred area where the god, where the ziggurat was, within this area, and where Nannar's, quarters were, you might say. And this was the last line of defense in battle. That's why they had an extra wall around it. If the outer wall was broken through and the enemy was starting to come in, everybody would flood into this sacred area, and so their God would protect them to the end, you know, and they had this extra wall right around there, and that was the last line of defense. And they kept a lot of chambers in here along the wall that were stocked with weapons for that last ditch defense. Apparently they didn't have much faith in their God, did they? They kept it supplied with weapons. It was also the site of the ziggurat, as I said, which was the house of Anar, who was also their king. In their concept, their king was their god. Anar was their, not only their god, but he was the king of the land. And I'm sure they had some prime minister or somebody under there to actually rule people, because his image isn't going to do much ruling. But they had a theocracy. God was their god, was their king. This is what God intended for Israel as well. But they wanted a human king. The Temenos was the moon god Paris. This was his quarters. This is where he lived, and apparently did whatever he did. But there were kitchens there within the Temenos for preparing the daily food for the gods that were offered up in worship. They'd have actual kitchens there to prepare the food for the gods, make sure they didn't get hungry. And presumably the priests were the ones who finally consumed it. But this food was offered up in worship. Also in front of the ziggurat was a large open court surrounded by many chambers. Right in front, there's an open court here. I'm not sure exactly what the layout of these things actually looked like, but there were numerous chambers there which served as a marketplace where the people bought gifts and paid taxes to the moon god. And it was kind of a marketplace there, and they come in and buy gifts and probably buy little images and idols and of the god, and they would pay their taxes to the moon god. That's where they paid their taxes to the...
This is in the sacred wall?
Yeah, this is within that Temenos area, that sacred area. It wouldn't be the average, it wouldn't be the normal, you know, the run-of-the-mill marketplace. It was kind of a special marketplace. Also in the Temenos were apartments for the priestess prostitutes, a common part of paganism. This is where they kept, you know, almost all of these pagan worship involved prostitution and temple prostitutes, and they would have the quarters for the priestesses there. This is where the Vestal Virgins and the nuns came from, actually. From the Roman Catholic Church. They came from in the Roman religion. They had these temple prostitutes as well. Canaanites and all of them all the way back. Later on, we'll talk about the Canaanites and see how bad it was for them. But this is almost a universal part of paganistic worship. This is one of the reasons that it was such a temptation for the children of Israel to get into these worshiping these false gods. It wasn't because they thought that they knew that these images couldn't do anything. They knew better than that. They'd seen, you know, before how God delivered them, and these other gods had no power. But it was the way that they worshiped, and getting into these orgies and getting drunk in orgies and all of this carnality and fornication. So what was a temptation to the flesh. And so this is one of the reasons why they got into a lot of these things. Now the city of Abraham was shown to exist then, and was very highly civilized at the time of Abraham. This is the kind of city that Abraham came from. His father and his family were worshiping the moon god, and God gave him a call and called him out of all this darkness and pagans and called him into the light. Yes.
In the city, they all had their pagan gods. Did they worship other gods too?
I get the impression that they did. They did have other gods, but they had one god that was supreme in their city, and this is the one that was going to be protecting them. They acknowledged the existence of these other gods, and I don't know how much we could say that they actually worshiped the other gods. Most of them worshiped the one that they had, but they acknowledged the existence of them, and I don't know what would happen if they visited another city or something. They probably just worshiped the god of that city too. Later on, we find in Ephesus, at the time of the New Testament, they had Diana and the Ephesians, and this is kind of a last remnant of this same thing. At that time, most of it had died off, but they were really fanatical in their worship of Diana, the Ephesians. So I think that, they get pretty attached to their own God. So in general, it appears that they worship their own God, but I know they acknowledge the existence of the other ones, too. And they talk about, this polytheism in their creation account. They have all these other gods involved, So I'm sure they acknowledge their existence. As far as what their worship of these was, I don't know. Okay. Secondly, some more evidence here concerning Abraham and his existence. First of all, we've seen that his, the city that he lived in existed at the time, and everything fits right into what it should be if Abraham did exist. But the name Abram has been discovered in tablets dating from the 6th century B.C. Now, this wouldn't be the same Abraham, but what does show us that that name existed back in those times, and maybe some of these others were named after Abraham, the original one. But Abram, of course, was his original name, and God changed it to Abraham. The name Abram is found in tablets dating from the 16th century B.C., which would be about 400 years after the time of Abraham. But nevertheless, it does indicate that that name was known back in those times. An Akkadian tablet dated in 1554 B.C. records the hiring of an ox by a farmer named Abarama. Abarama. Very close to Abraham. And this shows that the name was very familiar at that time. That was 1554 B.C. And Akkadian tablet. Akkadian refers to the same area, probably another tribe or another group within the Babylonian culture. Another Babylonian language is often called the Akkadian language. A-K-K-A-D-I. I'll just put it down. Sometimes it's spelled with C's, sometimes with K's. There's an Akkadian tablet. That's the language that was written.
Which city is that from? What area?
That's, I don't think I have that down. It would be in the Babylonian area at all. So, I'm not sure. Okay, now, looking back at Genesis chapter 11, verses 31 and 32, that verse we were just looking at. Notice it says he went from Ur of the Chaldees, and they came unto Haran and dwelt there. Okay, H-A-R-A-N. That city is up here in the northern part of Mesopotamia. And Haran also has been shown to be a flourishing city in the 18th and 19th century B.C. The 18th and 19th century B.C. was a flourishing city, so it must have been in existence before that time, which would fit right in the time of Abraham. This is according to many references in ancient cuneiform tablets. They haven't actually excavated Haran, but it's because of inscriptions and other tablets talking about this city. So we know that it was a flourishing city in the 18th and 19th centuries B.C. The town is still in existence right today, and so it hasn't been excavated. It's kind of hard to come in and tell people you're going to excavate their town, you know. You've got to move people out first, so it hasn't been excavated. They can't excavate right under people's houses and so forth.
Still called Haran?
I don't know. I don't know if it's still called that or not. It's probably in Arab territory, and they probably renamed it. It may be, though, as far as I know. Does anybody know for sure? Is it still called Haran?
H-O-R-A-N.
That sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Really?
Damascus still has its ancient name, so Damascus is probably the name. It's way, way back. Okay, also, Genesis 24:10 is another reference. These are just things that they found that all confirm the same thing. The city did exist, and this atmosphere did exist at that time, which was all denied by the critics long before. All denied all of it. It's all myth. And the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed. For all his goods and his master were in his hand, he arose and went to Mesopotamia unto the city of Nahor, unto the city of Nahor. Now the city of Nahor, I don't know if it's on our map here or not. Let's see it here. Okay, I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's in the Mesopotamia area. But Nahor is mentioned in what they call the Mari tablets, discovered in 1935. The Mari tablets, we're going to talk more about them later on. M-A-R-I. I think it's named after the modern name of the place that they were found. But in these tablets, the city of Nahor is mentioned, and in their language, it's called Nakur, N-A-K-H-U-R. Nakur, which is referring to the same place as Nahor. And so this place is also known to exist, and these tablets belong to the 18th century B.C. 18th century B.C. So we know that at that time the city of Nahor did exist. Also, there are many traces of Hebrew residents in these regions. The names of many of Abraham's ancestors and relatives have been found. A lot of the names of brothers and sisters and fathers and relatives of Abraham have been found in these different places, which show that there was a, you know, that this Hebrew influence was there. Of course, Abraham was the first of the Hebrews, and his relatives and his descendants and so forth, they found traces of their names and the fact that they did live in these different cities.
When you say traces of the name, you mean like they find a name like Henry or something like that, and just to show that it...
Right, and it was different, you know, the culture had already begun to be different, you know, after Abraham and his offspring, you know, they were separate from these others. And they found traces of the names of these people and relatives, and whether it be names of a place or something, or names of things or inscriptions on walls and things like this. They found traces of these as they've gone through.
But they normally be talking about the same person, not just the same name?
Well, not necessarily, but the name, you know, it shows that the names were there, and there's characteristic about the names as far as the language and so forth is different than the others. So they, what they mean by this is that there are traces of Hebrew residents in these regions. That Hebrew people did dwell in these areas, and because of names and so forth that were left, and whether or not it's actually the same individuals or not, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say that, but the evidence is there that these people did exist, so very well could have been the same one.
Would it be correct to say that I don't know how long Abraham was after the, you know, flood, ended, but there weren't very many people in comparison to now at all?
So no, there wouldn't be comparison to now, no. But although we find that. If you begin to start making population calculations, you'll find that the population grew very, very rapidly, especially because, see, you've got people living still, the longevity hasn't completely declined yet, and so right at the beginning of this period, you've got people that are living, you know, 100, 300 years and so forth, and they're bringing forth a lot of children during this time, and especially, you know, in the culture that they had with many wives and so forth, they can bring forth, you know, hundreds of children, each one, you know, individual, so you can see that these things can multiply much rapidly than it did, more rapidly than it did now. But by this time, you know, so soon after the flood, there, you know, there probably wouldn't be, you know, the same kind of population.
Wouldn't be too many names, really.
No, probably wouldn't. I mean, there would be. Yeah. Apparently, there's enough there that they feel pretty sure that, you know, this is pretty good evidence. And again, it is circumstantial evidence. Some of these things we're bringing out are not, you know, it's not definite, but it does indicate that these things could very well have taken place. In other words, there'd be no historical discrepancy between the events in the scriptures and what we actually find. We don't find an actual account, you know, of taking account of Abraham's existence, things like this. You wouldn't expect to anyway. But there's a lot of things here that all point to the same conclusion. Also, Genesis 12, verses 5 to 8. One more city here is mentioned, Bethel. Genesis 12, verses 5 to 8. I guess I'll just read the reference, but it just makes mention of the fact that Abraham was in Bethel, went to Bethel, and verses 5 and 8. Now, Bethel has been excavated. Excavations have shown that Bethel and Shechem were inhabited at Abraham's time. The city of Bethel and the city of Shechem were both inhabited at the time of Abraham. So Abraham very certainly could have gone to these cities. Of course, the critics have charged that a lot of these cities didn't exist back then, so how could Abraham go to cities that didn't exist? But archaeology has shown that they did exist in Abraham's time. Most of the critics say that the book of Genesis was written in the 8th to 9th century by priestly redactors, 8th to 9th century B.C. That's when the critics say the book of Genesis was written, and of course we know it was written back in the 15th century or so. But they say that it was written at this time. Now, if it was, these priestly redactors that wrote the book of Genesis, the probability is that they would not have put in cities that were not inhabited at that time. And a lot of these cities were destroyed and were not inhabited at the time that the priestly redactors wrote, but they were inhabited back at the time of Abraham. And so if they're writing about, you know, cities that existed at their time, they would not include a lot of these cities that were inhabited way back in the past of the time of Abraham. That's another argument against them, and we'll see some more arguments along those lines a little bit later on.
Is this word priestly redactors?
Priestly, yeah. What they say is that all these different documents were there, and the priests got together and compiled all these documents and made changes and so forth, took out all the polytheism and all this that was supposed to have been in there. See, they say that the religion of Israel evolved from pagan polytheism, and the original documents were polytheistic, and Genesis 1:26 is just an example where they slipped up and left that polytheistic influence in there, and that's making that argument. And so they say that that later on, in the 8th and 9th century, the priests got a hold of all these documents and began to make all these changes and put it all together. And if they had then composed it and put it together at that time, then you would expect them to have these cities and so forth quite a bit different. You'd expect it to reflect the time, that period of time, which the higher critics do say. They say that it reflects that period of time, not an earlier period of time. But archaeology has proven that wrong, because archaeology has proven that the things that happened in the 8th and 9th century were totally different than what's happened in these earlier centuries, and what the Bible says conforms to the earlier centuries, not to these late periods.
Also, the critics are saying that Erech and Shemet, or the, whatever the other cities, mm-hmm. the sea, those cities existed in the 8th and 9th century, but archaeologists have proven that these cities really did exist 2,000 years before Christ. Is that mm-hmm. what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Basically, so these cities that we're talking about here, Nahor and Bethel and some of these others, the higher critics are in a problem here, because they insisted that a lot of these cities didn't exist at the time of Abraham. But archaeologists have proven that they did exist at the time of Abraham. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them did not exist at the 8th and 9th century. And so they've got a real problem there, because all the evidence fits the earlier times.
You know, you happen to know if both Bethel and Shechem were not inhabited?
I don't know for sure. I know that there were some cities, but I'm not sure if those particular cities were among them. You can check that if you're interested. I'm not positive, though.
Mike, I'm not trying to give you a hard time, but why, if the book of Genesis was written in the 8th or 9th century, mm-hmm. per the higher critics, why couldn't they also agree that those cities were in existence beforehand? Because, like, they had history then, too,
mm-hmm.
and that they'd know about these other cities, even though they were destroyed. Such as we know about them, why wouldn't they know about them?
Well, they could, and that's an argument they'd probably try to use. Or they'd say that some of these earlier documents got it. But see, the problem is that if these cities did exist earlier at that time, then Abraham could have existed back at that time too, and that's what they're denying. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to admit that, because if they do, then they have to admit that Abraham did exist at that time too, and could have happened. All these things could have come back from that time. See, and they don't want to. They're denying. See, the denial here is that civilization and these things could have happened back at those times, 2000 B.C. And so if they begin to admit that these cities and so forth existed back then, they're going to have to, of course, admit together. They don't want to do that. So they're trying to pull it all up here to the 8th and 9th century. Okay? That'll get a little clearer. There's another piece of information that fits into that. We'll get to that later. We'll talk about the patriarchal life and the customs of the patriarchs, and that's really interesting, and found some tablets that really confirm that all right down the line. Now, Genesis 14, let's turn to Genesis 14 and look at, I'm going to have to take time to read this whole chapter, but if you read the whole chapter here, this is a story of some kings that came up against Abraham. Just read verse 1 here, 1 and 2. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, and Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. There's a battle between some kings. It mentions the names of different kings of different areas, and it indicates that one area of kings got together and fought another area of kings. Abraham got involved in this, as you see right later on as you read down through the chapter. Now, I guess just looking at verse 11, and they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went away. So there was a battle that took place between a number of these kings, and the critics attached this entire chapter and said it was all mythological, that none of these kings ever existed, and they had three grounds for saying it was mythological. The first was that the names of these kings were fictitious. They said all these names are fictitious, they're just made up. There's no evidence in history of any of these kings existing. So, of course, they didn't have any archaeology at the time to challenge it. But they said the names were all fictitious. Then, secondly, they said there was no such travel from Mesopotamia to Palestine in that day. See, some of these kings are coming over here from Mesopotamia and attacking some kings at Sodom and Gomorrah down here at the south part of the Dead Sea. So they're having travel here from Mesopotamia to Palestine, according to the scripture. But the critics said that there was no such travel in that day. They didn't travel like that back in those days. And thirdly, they said that the route that the eastern kings took, according to the scriptures, they're described the route that they took into Palestine didn't exist. They said that this route didn't exist into Palestine at that time. So they wrote the whole thing off as fictitious and as mythological, because these things just couldn't have been. And again, it has to do with the evolutionary assumption behind the whole thing. Now, archaeology has since identified Chedorlaomer Omer and Arioch. These are two of the kings that were mentioned there. These two kings, Chedorlaomer and Arioch, are found in the Mari and Elamite sources, Mari tablets and some other Elamite sources, tablets, showing that these kings did exist at this time. So archaeology has confirmed the existence of two of these kings. They haven't found every single one of them, but they did find these two kings and confirmed this one aspect of it. So their charge that the kings were all imaginary is without ground. They found some of them. They haven't found all of them, but they have confirmed that somebody did exist right at that time, so we can assume the rest of them did too.
Those tablets were from the ancient people of?
The Mari tablets, M-A-R-I, those ones I mentioned earlier, and some Elamite sources, Elamite, E-L-A-M-I-T-E, the Elamites.
Which
kings are those? Chedorlaomer, C-H-E-D-O-R-L-A-O-M-E-R, you get the spelling out of the scripture reference there, and Arioch, A-R-I-O-C-H, these two are known to have existed. Okay, now concerning the second point, that there was no such travel from Mesopotamia to Palestine, they said that this kind of travel didn't exist, that people weren't traveling these long distances. A Babylonian wagon contract dating from shortly after Hammurabi's time states that the wagon hired must not be driven to the coast of the Mediterranean. It was a rental agreement that they dug up. Babylonian rent-a-car or something. They were renting wagons out, you know, for people to rent a wagon to, you know, travel distances. And one of the conditions on this rental agreement was that the wagon was not to be driven to the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, which would be over here in Palestine. See, the wagon contract made me in here, and they said, you're not to drive it here to the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Now, you wouldn't say that unless people were doing it. You don't tell them not to do something that they weren't doing anyway. And so the evidence is that people were traveling from Babylonia to Mesopotamia. Otherwise, you wouldn't write a rental agreement telling him not to do it.
Well, what would be the date on that?
Okay, this was shortly after Hammurabi's time. And it's 728. And now, this is the late time of Hammurabi. It could be back at around 2000. Either back at around 2000 or from 728 to 1676 B.C.
1728?
Yeah, 1728 to 1676 B.C. That's the latest time that it could have been. But a lot of sources favor Hammurabi being back in 2000. In fact, remember that one, King Amraphel, that first one in that verse, Amraphel? Many identified him with Hammurabi. Amraphel and Hammurabi may have been the same person. But they're not real certain about it. There's not enough evidence to really tie it down. So let's assume that this is the latest. 870, but this is about 300 years after, and they were certainly traveling. By that time, they were writing rental agreements and renting wagons and things like this. So obviously, they've been traveling those distances for quite some time, because you don't rent things out to people and people until things that have, you know, have settled to the point where it was a pretty safe thing to do.
How far is that? Looks about 700 miles.
No, it's not quite. Let's see. Here we got 400 miles. I guess it might be 400 miles. Yeah, we're about right. Just 700 miles.
Well, those were Babylon wagons, and they didn't want to rent them out. So you're saying that they didn't want to rent out their own wagons
because
you didn't want the wagons
bought
that spot.
That's right. And you might have problems, you might break down or something. They call it a service station.
Yeah. Can you show you where the agreement was found?
I would assume it was in Babylon, or, you know, one of the cities of Babylon. I don't have a city down itself. You might be able to find that. The reference for this is, well, I'll get the reference next time. I'm going to look it up.
Maybe
it's
easy to go to the church. You're going to have to go out like running. That's good.